Okay, good afternoon.
Boy, what a success.
Yeah. Welcome. And thank you very much for coming to this new series on the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. I'll take the opportunity now to ask people to please silence their cell phones, silence, vibrate, whatever works that will avoid ringing at some point during the class would be helpful. I'm grateful to Joyce and to Rebecca and Mikko Rose.
Popular.
It's the book. It's the book. So please make sure that Joyce has your email address if you're planning on coming to the class, because I like to send out the source sheets in advance and to follow up by email after the class as well. So please make sure that Joyce has your email address and she'll get it to me to add to the list. Fair?
I don't want to be crass, but we also make sure Joyce has your check.
That's also true. Okay. I will note that the parking lot here is not always open the way that it is happens to be, you know, today. There is a code, though, to get out of the lot that will work for this class. I don't remember. Everyone's like ready to write it down.
Well, last year,
I know.
Is it a choice? Do you know if it's the same class?
It's the same, but I'm going to try and ask them to keep it open for class, but that makes
okay.
Sense.
Well, Karen, what is it for instance?
329-1818.
Pounds, right? It's 329-1818. Followed by your birthday. No. 329-1818 pounds. But Joyce said she's going to see about possibly keeping it open in general for this class, and I think that may be helpful. Okay. So our topic for the year is Ezra/Nehemiah. That's our the books/book, as I'll talk about, that we're going to be studying. It's an important period in Jewish history. The books themselves are very significant. I'll ask the question to you first. Why does it matter? Why do we want to learn about Ezra and Nehemiah in particular? What might we stand to gain from these books?
The reestablishment of the Jewish nation, so we can compare it to today.
Reestablishment of the Jewish people after their exile, to compare it to our reestablishment today with the new state. Yes, Dalia.
The fact that their reiteration of Judaism was completely different from the Mosaic tradition.
I would argue that
people call, you know, the new Moses and the new.
Right. Certainly what Ezra and Nehemiah did shaped Jewish life in ways that still affect us today. I wouldn't accept the statement that it was entirely different, and we'll see as we go through the book the points that I think do reflect what was already there. But without a doubt, they shaped Jewish life in ways that continue to reverberate. And frankly, there are personal lessons as well. It isn't all about national identity. Meaning, there are lessons to be learned about how one rebuilds after tragedy. This is a nation that had been living high, so to speak, in the days going back to David and Solomon, and even after that had gone through periods of wealth and even periods of dominance, periods of territorial enlargement, and then they got crushed. First the northern kingdom by the Assyrians, and then the southern kingdom by the Babylonians/Egyptians. And they spent 70 years, as we'll talk about, in exile. And now they're reborn. What does that mean for a nation to return to prominence, or to try to return to prominence, after that kind of devastation? And what can we learn for our own individual existences as well? So the books of Ezra and Nehemiah clearly are our main focus, but I want to note that there are actually a lot of other books in Tanakh that we need to know or to know about in order to get Ezra and Nehemiah. They're not in a vacuum. I include it on your sheet. If you take a look at the first source, and thank you, Rabbi Ostringer, for making additional copies in the office. As a general rule, as I said, I send out the sheets in advance. I usually bring about 15 copies to the class that I make at home. If we sustain our group, then 15 won't be sufficient. I'm not sure how we'll deal with that, but I would suggest that people do print off copies as well. But if you take a look at the first source, the first note, I listed there four, seven, 10 other books of Tanakh that are important to know about in the context of Ezra and Nehemiah. The first group, Malachim Bet, the second half of the book of Malachim, Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Divrei HaYamim. I should note, when I refer to books in Tanakh in this class, I tend to use the Hebrew name of the book. So, if something isn't clear, ask me, but that's my default in general. So Malachim is Kings, Yeshaya is Isaiah, Yirmiyah is Jeremiah, Divrei HaYamim is Chronicles. Those books give a series of events that lead up to the Babylonian exile, and we'll be going through some excerpts shortly from those books. Then you have the next three that I list there, Ezekiel, Daniel, and Esther. And those are books that describe events from the exile. Yechezkel, Ezekiel starts out before the Babylonian exile, before the first temple is destroyed, and then continues into the exile with prophecies to the exiled Jews. The book of Daniel describes the arc of King Nebuchadnezzar and his experiences. It's really more about him in the beginning. And then Daniel's prophecies in the early days of the Persian Empire, when we're still in that 70-year exile. And then, of course, the book of Esther. Now, including the book of Esther in this part is actually cheating, because Esther doesn't really occur during the exile. It really describes events that occur under the Persians after the Jews have already been given permission to return. The reason why I call it an exile book is because it describes the events that occur to Jews who are still living in that exile. How many times in the book of Esther do we make any reference to the Jews who have returned to Israel, built an altar, and started up sacrifices and so on? One was close, but on The Price is Right, you would be over. The answer is zero. There is no reference in the book of Esther to the Jews who have returned. It's an exile book, and that's why I include it there. That's something that's actually worthy of its own discussion. Yes. I'm going to get to some dates. Not quite there yet. And then the last three books that I list, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, all of which are found in Treasar, the collection of the small books of prophecy. Haggai and Zechariah are actually going to be mentioned in the book of Ezra in chapters 5 and 6. They prophesy for the Jews, trying to encourage them to build, and then Malachi is the generation following that, as we'll end up talking about, I think, somewhat. So all of these books interface in some way with the events that are going on in Ezra. That doesn't mean that we're going to spend our year studying 10 other books and not Ezra and Nehemiah, but we are going to refer to these books in setting the stage for what happens in Ezra and Nehemiah, and then we're going to go further from there, from that context. Books that I'm not going to get into, but I want you to know about. The Septuagint actually has two books called Ezra. The Septuagint is supposed to be the translation of Tanakh into Greek. It actually has two translations of Ezra. And then there's something called the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha are external books, books that do not make it into the canon of Tanakh. And there's a work in there called The Vision of Ezra. Why don't those books make it in? Is it because there was a particular philosophical objection to something within these apocryphal books? Was it because they were written too late? There's all sorts of nice discussions you can have about the Apocrypha beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. But you should know there is a book called The Vision of Ezra that's also found in the Apocrypha. So you have all these other books also that are out there, you know, operating under the Ezra brand. In general, just to know about also that things that you should be aware of. If you have the Hebrew for it, this is from the Dat Mikra edition of Tanakh. I find the Dat Mikra edition in general very worth reading, but in particular, they have introductions as well as appendices that add very useful information on the book that you're discussing, whether you're talking about historical information, whether you're talking about some of the archaeological finds, whether you're talking about interaction between the particular book and another work in Tanakh. It's generally very useful, and I recommend the Dat Mikra edition. I also gave you, in source number 2, a link to a 3-part series on Ezra and Nehemiah by Rabbi Chaim Angel. Those who were at the Bayit for Shabbos a few weeks ago heard him speak. He was a scholar in residence there. In general, he's very good. He's a professor of Tanakh at Yeshiva University. He's also, I'm blanking on the official title, but something along the lines of community scholar at the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in Arzia KJ. Might be at KJ, at KJ in Manhattan, at a shul in Manhattan. But he's very worth listening to. It's a 3-part series. He's very easy to listen to. And I would recommend for those who want more to catch that, to download that and listen to it. There are various popular books on the era as well. One of them, Ralph, had brought in the review for one of them. Dov Zakheim, who was an official in the U.S. government, wrote a book called Nehemiah, which I've read part of. I haven't yet finished it. And it basically, he reflects on lessons to learn from Nehemiah as somebody who was a high up in the American government, because Nehemiah was a high up in the Persian government, and that's how Nehemiah ends up coming back to Israel, is with license from the Persians. So he sort of sees parallels between his experience and Nehemiah's experience. It's an interesting read, at least the part that I've read so far. And then there's another work which is relevant also, although it's not directly on the book of Ezra, and that is from Yoram Chazoni, the work The Dawn, on the book of Esther and the political issues that are surrounding the book of Esther. Also an interesting read that you may want to know about. But we're not reading The Dawn, we're not reading Zakham's book, we're working on Ezra and Nehemiah, and what I want to cover this year is the following. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah themselves, the historical setting in which they take place, the importance of the events that they describe for Jewish history, the roles played by Ezra and Nehemiah themselves, as well as the other key players in the books, because really, anybody know, what chapter does Ezra actually show up in? When does Ezra first appear in the book of Ezra? Chapter 6. 6 or 7. You have a lot to go. I mean, consider it's only a 10-chapter book. You know, you get to make your appearance midway through the movie. So there are other leaders and other figures to know about, but certainly we want to know about their roles and the impact of Ezra and Nehemiah personally on Judaism. So talking about these books of Ezra and Nehemiah and what they are not. They're not really about Ezra and Nehemiah personally. As I said, Ezra doesn't show up until midway through the book and even further. Nehemiah won't show up until the part that bears his name, which is the part that we now call Nehemiah. And they're not really history books. And the way we know that is that it's missing significant description of the Jewish people, of the Persian kings, except insofar as they matter because they let us return to the land. If you were writing a work of history, this isn't the way you would write it. It can be confusing because you have things like lists of names, which make you think, well, this must be a history book because why in the world are you recording all these family names and numbers and so forth? But don't confuse it for a history book because it's not. In the event that there is something there that looks like a historical detail, we have to ask ourselves, why did the author include this? What was the author trying to do if this really isn't a history book and yet it includes all this history? What they are about? Milestones in the national return to Israel and the building of the Second Temple. I brought you in source number 3 an interesting note from the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. The piece from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in context, he's talking about why it is that Tanakh will sometimes give us stories and will sometimes omit stories. Sometimes there are things which, on the face of it, should be there, but they're just not. So, for example, the Jewish life of Jews in Tanakh is largely missing. we don't find anybody taking their new suit to the Schottenitz tester, you know, or even just saying, well, no, I can't have woolen linen. We don't have a whole lot of discussion of kashrut, right? Things that we think of as part of our of normal daily Jewish life aren't really there. So the Kuzari, in his attempt to address this in source number 3, and I excerpted, I didn't bring you the entire passage, but he writes, Kosev HaMikra, the author of the text, Lo Hir Gish Linistarot. He wasn't concerned really with hidden matters, meaning things that went on in private. I'm going to go back and forth, by the way, for those who haven't taken a class with me yet, I go back and forth between Ashkenaz and Sfard, and it's terrible. It's really atrocious, and I apologize. But I have reached a stage of being stuck in between two worlds, and I can't make the leap to one or the other. So I apologize for the pain I am inflicting on the ears of Hebrew speakers.
It's colorful.
Yeah. That's one word for it. So, in any case, the author of the text isn't concerned with what goes on in private. He's writing about things that were well known, that were public. So that, for example, V'lo ha'etik mi Yehoshua mechochmaso shekibel me'elokim mi'moshe davar. Yehoshua spends his entire life learning. Right? We're told about Yehoshua, he never strayed from Moshe's tent. Not once do we find what it was that Yehoshua learned or what he taught the nation. We find speeches he gave of, you know, rebuke and instruction to the nation in terms of sticking to the commands of God and conquering the land and not living among the Canaanites. But we never find that we would do with Moshe that Yehoshua actually learns a law or teaches a law, even though we know that it's going on. It's not there, Abal Zachar Yom Amidas HaYarden, but it does mention the day that the Jordan stood still so the Jews could cross. V'chein lo kasa mitivrei Ezra u'Nechemiah la'mufrala ha'mufursam ba'amon. And so too, regarding Ezra and Nechemiah, and that's really the point why, that's the reason I'm mentioning it here. It doesn't mention about Ezra and Nechemiah what went on within their own lives. Only that which was publicly known in their day got recorded. So again, it's not a full history. It's going to present us with certain central public moments that we are supposed to get. Perhaps also there's another goal here, and that is legitimization of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, and everything that Ezra and Nehemiah built. Meaning, well, take a look at source number 4. This is a passage regarding the book of Divrei Hayamim, the book of Chronicles. And Don Isaac Abarbanel wants to know why it is that we were given the record of Chronicles, this history book. What's the point of the history found in the book of Divrei Hayamim? And so Abarbanel says, Kasher ra'ah sofer ha'shalem hazeh, when this complete scribe, meaning Ezra, when he saw Shashbatim asher huglu ashura safu, he saw that the tribes exiled to Assyria, the northern kingdom, had been finished. V'nosra bas Tzion, the daughter of Tzion remained, meaning Yehuda, the south, Judea, and they're, you know, coming back from Babylon. Well, they're in Babylon at this point. V'ra'a gam kein sham malchus be'emes nasan elokim l'David u'zaro ad olam. And he saw that God had given true monarchy to David and to his line. U'shara malachim asher malchu b'Yisrael mishara shvatim lo ayu kafi ha'ratzon ha'eloki. And that God did not desire the kings who reigned from other tribes. V'shele asil avo lo yishar ki malchus beis David. And that in the future only the Davidic line is going to remain. Chashav l'malas ha'melech David l'saper yichuso v'yichus shivto v'inyanav u'ma'asav kulam ha'morim ha'shlemuso. So Ezra said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write what today would be called a propaganda piece. I'm going to write a book which only talks about where King David and his line came from and the events which demonstrate how wonderful they are. And the chain of monarchy that came from his descendants. So when you look in Divrei Hayamim, you miss some of the gory details, emphasis on the gory, that are found in Sefer Shmuel, in the book of Samuel, because it won't contribute to supporting the restoration of the Davidic line. Divrei Hayamim, as Abarbanel sees it, is meant to promote the monarchy of David HaMelech, of King David. That's what it's there for. And what I'm going to suggest is that maybe the books of Ezra and Nehemiah along the same lines are meant to promote the return of the Jews under the second, the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, and to demonstrate the sources of their authority. Yes, Carla.
Would it also promote, because he described the story, the new function for Zerubbabel?
Possibly. In other words, in his day, that would have been an issue.
Right.
Correct. Yeah, I think it's not just about Ezra, Nehemiah, and the second Beis HaMikdash, but also what we think of as the more minor characters, just because their name doesn't get on the book. But yes, all of the leaders of that day and their authority to do the things that they did, all of them are being supported by the recording of this book. I would agree with that. The only note would be that I think by the time you get to canonization, those are less significant. Zerubbabel doesn't matter. Right, except in most sort. The Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel, Kates Shavim Noshanti. See that? We know who Zerubbabel is. Okay. Hanukkah time. They, bless you. So, who are the figures in our neighborhood? Who are the people we need to know about? A little bit of an overview, and here we'll get to the dates as well. A little bit of the chronology. So first I want to introduce you to people we're not going to know a whole lot about, but you can't really discuss this era without knowing, you know, something about them. And those are the Persian kings. I mentioned already the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple, is destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar. The Babylonians reign for a few decades after that, and then the Persians come along, and they conquer the Babylonian Empire. And it's really, even though we call it the Babylonian exile, at the stage that Ezra picks up, Babylonians are gone. We're actually living under the Persians. So that's just a general point to be aware of. The conqueror of the Babylonians was Cyrus the Great. And we generally assume that Cyrus is Koresh. Makes sense as a cognate. And that's the first king I list there. He officially took the Persian throne in the year 559 before the Common Era, but conquers Babylon in the year 539 before the Common Era, and reigns until the year 530 before the Common Era. He is the founder of what is called the Achaemenid dynasty. His successor is a fellow by the name of Cambyses II. Cambyses I was before Cyrus. He's not on our list because he's before the conquest of the Babylonians. Cambyses II, followed by Darius I, followed by Xerxes and Artaxerxes, who is followed in turn by Darius II, who is followed by Artaxerxes II, who is followed by Artaxerxes III, who is followed by Arses, who is followed by Darius III, and then in comes Alexander the Great, and that's it for the Persians. I don't know that all by heart. I've got it written down in my notes. But I listed here specifically these five, because these are the five who overlap with the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Meaning, once you get to Artaxerxes I, he's the last one we have. Now, in parentheses I gave you, in source number 5, names in Hebrew that may be the kings we refer to in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, in other words, trying to draw parallels. There are different approaches among historians as far as how these parallels are done. I took one school, which I think is a reasonable school, but there are others. If you want to know more about this, like so much more that it gives you a really solid headache, there's a fellow by the name of Mitchell First. I believe he's a lawyer by trade, from New Jersey. And he wrote extensively on this period and trying to match up kings with their the biblical kings with the Persian kings. His book is called Jewish History in Conflict. And really, if you want a good solid headache, that's the way to go. The problem is deeper than which king in Hebrew is, you know, this king whose name we're given in the Persian. It's more complex than that. And here I'm going to mention briefly a chronological problem, which I am not going to solve in the course of this class, but you have to know about it. You can't learn this period without knowing about it. So here goes. Anybody know how long the Second Temple stood?
500 years.
Mm. close, but like him before, you're over. Well, you may not be over. I shouldn't say that. So the classical chronology that that Jewish tradition has used comes from a work of Midrash called Seder Olam. And Seder Olam says the first temple stood for 410 years, the second temple stood for 420 years. Because we are told that the second temple is going to be greater than the first. That's a prophecy given to the Jews. So 420 is bigger than 410, ergo. But the idea is that that temple stood for 420 years. Now, here's your problem. What year is the second temple destroyed? Roughly the year 70, 68, 69, 70, there is some dispute. Correct, by the Romans. So that's you know, if you do the math, and this involves negative numbers and all that, so you know, if you don't like math, you can just listen. But let's round it off and say that it's destroyed in the year 70, and you subtract 420 years from there. What year BCE should it have been built? 350. In the year of which Persian king would that have been? You start to see the problem. Right. According to that chronology, it was built 18 years before Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire. And that just doesn't work. It just flat out doesn't work. Because we're going to see them start the construction of the Second Temple in the beginning of the Book of Ezra, and we're going to see events that occur within those next decades under the Persians. We're going to see four Persian kings, Koresh, Cyrus, Dariavesh, Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes, they're all going to be mentioned in Ezra. It doesn't fit. So there are various answers that have been suggested for this problem. One answer that's been suggested is that actually the construction period takes a very long time, and therefore don't count the beginning of the construction from the beginning of the Book of Ezra, but rather it actually, the count of the 420 years starts much later. Now, when you learn the Book of Ezra, that's going to make a lot of sense to you. Because the truth of the matter is, and if you learn Haggai, you'll see it as well there, they take a very long time getting underway. For a long time, they just have an altar and no building. So it's not such a strange answer. It's a little hard still to make it work with the chronology, but that's one approach. A second approach that's offered is to suggest that maybe they actually deliberately botched the numbers. If you remember the Book of Daniel, we did the Book of Daniel here a few years ago, so you know that Daniel is told to record his prophecies and to seal them up so that no one can understand them. And he did a very good job. But the goal of him sealing the prophecies was because he mentions how many years it's going to be until the arrival of Mashiach, and you're not supposed to be able to figure that out. So therefore, he mixes different things up, and maybe this is part of that. We're just going to mix up the numbers, and therefore you won't know what the math should be, and therefore you'll be confused about when the Messiah is going to arrive. Not unpacking that idea in great detail, but that's another explanation for why this is so. There are other approaches. Another approach is, and this is also historically correct, that Persian kings, even though they're listed with different names, aren't necessarily different people. And sometimes the names and the numbers, so to speak, get mixed up. And that could be, and that could account maybe for some of it. The bottom line is, as I said, I'm not going to solve the problem, but I need to give you that introduction in order for you to understand that the numbers you see on the sheet for the Persian kings are based on a secular chronology, which if you try to match it up to Seder Olam, is not going to work. If you try to match it up to the Midrash and the idea that the Second Temple is built in the year 350 before the Common Era, it's simply not going to work. So you have to keep in your head two different ideas, fundamentally, which is that within the Midrash's count, the Second Temple is built and the events of Ezra are going on in the middle of the 4th century before the Common Era. Whereas the historians are going to tell you that it's actually going on in the beginning of the 6th century, or the end of, as now you look at it, the end of the 6th century before the Common Era. In other words, their belief is that the Second Temple is actually being built. If you look at your chronology, you can see it here. Sometime around the year 516 or so before the Common Era, depending on which Persian king is whom. That's what's going to determine it. But sometime around the period of Darius the First is when you're going to get the Second Temple being built. Is that somewhat clear? Somewhat. you have to know you're dealing with two different chronologies, and it's an unfortunate reality, but in our favor, no, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time working out the years in the course of the book. So if you don't like the math, don't worry.
Wasn't that based on the Midrash that the second temple started 70 years after?
Right. So the idea of the 70 is not Midrash. The idea of 70 is actually biblical. We're going to find it. The biblical text itself says that it was a 70-year gap. So we have, you know, we have that testimony to it. The question is only which 70. And not only which 70 in terms of what century do those 70 take place, but even how do you count your 70? Right? If you're familiar with the Midrashim about Ahasuerus miscounting and Belshazzar miscounting, is it 70 years from when Nebuchadnezzar first conquered Judea? Is it 70 years from when he exiled the leadership? Is it 70 years from when the temple was destroyed? That's also part of the part of the calendar game. Now, to add to the complications, in terms of, I said that it's hard to figure out who exactly these kings are. The kings were recorded in the book of Ezra, and the kings were recorded in the secular list. One of the reasons why it's difficult is because Jewish tradition in general has not cared a whole lot about foreign kings. It just wasn't a priority of ours. Like, you want to know why the book of Ezra doesn't tell us about the private life of Cyrus? The answer is because we're not so interested in Cyrus. And the proof of it is that there will only be four Persian kings named in the book of Ezra, even though the secular chronology says that there was a fifth in there, Cambyses II. He's not mentioned at all in the book of Ezra. We don't seem to mention him. There's even a possibility of Darius II, but I'm not going to go in there. But further to the same point, source number 6. The Talmud in Rosh Hashanah is dealing with a problem we're going to have to come back to, which is a little bit of a calendar issue on the Jewish calendar as recorded in the book of Ezra. At what point is the new year beginning? At what point do we say, now is a new year? What month is the first month of the new year? Yes. And it causes all sorts of confusion as to whether it's Tishrei that's the start of the new year or Nisan that's the start of the new year. And they try to work it out with the different kings, and the result of it in one suggestion in source number 6 is the suggestion, Tana, it was taught, who Koresh, who Dayavesh, who Artaxasta? The answer is that Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxasta, who may be, you know, Artaxerxes, they're all the same person. Maybe they were just all the same person, and that would solve our problem. We can work out our textual problem by suggesting that all three people were actually the same person, and it doesn't bother us, midrashically, to make that suggestion. Now, they might be annoyed. Right? I mean, Cyrus might be annoyed. You think I'm Darius? It might bother them, but it doesn't bother us because, frankly, they're players in a game, but the game isn't about them. And so, and that's reflected there. And not only that, not only Talmudically is that so, but in terms of the classic commentaries as well. Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, who we usually think of as a supreme literalist and somebody who might care about a historical detail like this. Take a look, please, at source number 7, a comment that he makes in chapter 4 of Ezra. When we are introduced to Daryavesh, or Daryavesh is mentioned, I should say, this is the first Daryavesh mentioned in the book, he says, oh yeah, who Ahasuerus? He says, you should know, Daryavesh in the book is Ahasuerus. However, two chapters later, in source number 8, we find a mention of Daryavesh, and there we have a problem in terms of the order of mentioning Daryavesh and Artaxasta. Don't worry about that order issue right now. It's not the point. The point is that Daryavesh, he says, is who has a Kain Hamadi. This refers to Darius the Mede, who's mentioned in the book of Daniel. And then he says, Artaxasta, he is Ahasuerus. And then Daryavesh is the son of Ahasuerus. What he ends up saying essentially, and again, I don't want to get too bogged down in this right now, is that in source number 7, he says that Darius is Ahasuerus. In source number 8, he says that Darius is the son of Ahasuerus. Problem. He's inconsistent. That's the answer. He's talking about the same Darius. And yet in one case he is Ahasuerus, in one place he is the son of Ahasuerus. And by the way, in his comments to the first pasuk in Megillas Esther, he suggests that there were two Ahasuerus. Because the book of Esther begins, and it was in the days of Ahasuerus, who Ahasuerus hamolech mehodu ve'agush. He was Achashverosh who reigned from Hodu to Kush. So Ibn Ezra says, well, maybe there were two Achashveroshes, and one of them reigned from Hodu to Kush, and one of them did not, and that's why the book needs to specify this is the Achashverosh we're talking about. My point is simply to say that, in general, we didn't prioritize foreign kings and didn't spend a whole lot of time trying to figure out who was whom. That's really what I'm getting at here. Yes?
Aren't there any sources in Persian history?
Yes. So that's how we get the list of kings I mentioned. In other words, that's how we get Cyrus, Cambyses, Darius, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, and all the Dariuses and Artaxerxes who follow. That's how we get them. It's from, well, not all from Persian chronology. Some of them are from Herodotus, writing in Greek times, which is a problem. I know I'm mispronouncing his name.
There's been a similar confusion.
So, to a limited extent, not to the extent that we're confused. But yes, because remember that the Greeks are centuries later and they're reconstructing. Yes, Carla.
The Romans has actually lived in Persian times. It's like,
how early is he?
He's like 4th, 5th century.
4th, 5th, so he's still...
No, but he's still in Persian times.
Right, no, he's still... Right, technically he's still within Persian times in that sense.
Herodotus.
The... Yes. Now, my point is only that he's 2 centuries after Cyrus. Yes. Now that's fair. So if we're trying to answer the question of when is this taking place, the answer that I can give as a firm answer is that your starting point is roughly 70 years after the first temple is destroyed. However, in terms of figuring out when that was, and then how long the Second Temple stood, you really have these two different avenues to go to work with. Either placing it very early in the 6th century before the Common Era, or placing it later in the 4th century before the Common Era. That's really the distinction. Okay, that's the confusing part. If you got through that, really everything else after that is easy. In all seriousness, that's like the most confusing thing we're going to see this year. It was a good thing for the first week. This business of the Persian kings. The other people we need to know about who we're going to meet are listed in source number 9, the bottom of the first side of the sheet. The leaders before Ezra and Nehemiah. So we will find a reference to a man by the name of Sheshbazzar, who is the political leader of Judea being the southern kingdom and all that remains of the Jews in the land of Israel, at the outset of the return. We'll see him right away from the beginning of the book. Descendant of King David. Then you have Zerubbabel, who will ascend from Babylon/Persia, and be the political leader of the Jews in Judea starting in the 3rd chapter. He seems to replace Sheshbazzar, also descendant of King David. Then you have Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak, who will be the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, when the altar is first built and they begin work on the second temple. He's the one who Zechariah refers to in his classic vision of the Kohen Gadol, Yehoshua, standing in dirty clothing and then having the dirty clothing removed and being given fresh clean clothing to represent the forgiveness of the Jews. That's Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And then you have Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, who are prophets in that period. So those are just names of people we're going to meet and a little bit of information about them. So let's talk about the books.
Did their lives overlap?
I'm sorry?
Did their lives overlap?
Yes. You mean Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi? Well, their lives overlap, but not their reign. In other words, Sheshbazzar, Zerubbabel, well, you'll see about Zerubbabel. Sheshbazzar is gone before Ezra shows up. The rest of them we'll have to see as we go through. In terms of Ezra and Nehemiah themselves, Ezra is apparently a spiritual leader of Jews in Babel, in Babylon, who is sent by the king, by Dariavesh, I'm sorry, by Artaxasta, to lead the Jews, and then Nebuchadnezzar is an official in the court of King Artaxasta, who wins his support to come to Judea and build up Jerusalem. Let's talk about the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, the books themselves. So first of all, I alluded to this already in the beginning. Are they one book or two? So the Gemara says they're one book. It isn't Ezra one book, Nehemiah one book, but it's one book. It's called the Book of Ezra. Simplest evidence for it is source number 10. When the Talmud gives us the order of the books that are in Tanakh, Sidran Shel Ketuvim, the order of the books in Ketuvim, so you see it. Ruth, Sefer Tehillim, Iyov, Megillat Esther, Ezra, V'divrei HaYamim. Ezra and Chronicles. There is no mention of a book of Nehemiah. It's all included in the book of Ezra. Not that they didn't have a book of Nehemiah. We will see right now that they certainly did, and it was part of the book of Ezra. Take a look at source number 11. 11 makes it very clear that Nehemiah is part of Ezra's book to them. The Gemara asks a question. Source number 11. Michti kol mili de Ezra Nehemiah ben Chakalia amrinu. Everything that happens with Ezra is recorded by Nehemiah. They don't mean literally everything that Ezra does. But much of what Ezra does is actually recorded by Nehemiah in his book. He's the one who reports it. Nehemiah ben Chakalia, my time alo ikri sifra al shmei. So why isn't the book named Nehemiah? Asks the Talmud. To which we answer, well, it is. But the Talmud doesn't know that. For them, it's part of the book of Ezra. So they want to know, why is it that it's not called the book of Nehemiah? And Rabbi Yirmiyah Bar Abba gives us one answer. He says, "Nimnei shehechzik tova la'atzmo," because he took credit for himself. When we get to Nehemiah chapter 5, you'll see he talks about the wonders of what he has done. It's a little bit too arrogant for us. We don't like the idea of calling the book on his name if he takes credit for things. And then the second answer that's offered is the answer from Rabbi Yosef, Mimnesha Siper Bignu San Shall Rishonim, because he degraded those who had preceded him, possibly even Daniel, and we'll talk about that again when we get to chapter 5 in Nehemiah, God willing, Imherabi Amenu one day. But the point is that, and the reason I bring it is to show you, they didn't know that the book would be called Nehemiah, they didn't know that it would be two books. It was clearly one book at the time, and Rashi says so as well. If you take a look at source number 12, but here you need to be able to read the Hebrew as well in order to understand what happened. The Rashi is simply explaining a word in the Talmud. The word is ma'aziva. A ma'aziva is essentially a gutter used for draining a roof, right? Ayin zayin bet, to leave, to cause something. Ma'aziva causes the water to leave the roof, to drain from the roof. So Rashi says on ma'aziva, tiach shel sid al tikra. It is a lime lining on a roof. V'domelo b'sefer Ezra. Similarly, he says, look in the book of Ezra. And he quotes you a verse, which is Nehemiah, chapter 3, sentence 8. But Rashi calls it the book of Ezra, because as far as Rashi is concerned, they're just one book, and they're all called Ezra. So the question is, when did we start splitting it? Yeah, Maxine.
In a way, it's amazing that the book is not titled the book of Nehemiah.
Right.
Because it took Ezra such a long time to come from Babylon. He didn't want to leave his teacher.
So I'm not sure that chronologically that works. In other words, it's correct that Ezra remains for a long time in the exile after Jews have begun coming back. But as far as I understand it, Nehemiah isn't there yet. Nehemiah has a few chapters to go, so to speak, before he shows up. Ezra's already in the
land. Nehemiah was insecure of the area where the...
Certainly going based on the chronology of the book, it's not. Nehemiah is showing up later. Paul, you were going to... Okay. So, in terms of the split between them, the Christians actually split the text going back to the 3rd century Common Era. Bishop Origen, when he writes his commentaries to Tanakh and the Vulgate edition in the 4th century Common Era, they split them. However, as already noted, Rashi isn't splitting them. Rashi is centuries and centuries after that. The first time we find in Jewish texts that they are split is the 15th century. Until then, it appears, it's very common to view them as one book. Now, interestingly, some argue that the books actually were written originally to be two different books, different authors, and were not meant to be one book at the start. And that Ezra may even be viewed as an extension of Divrei HaYamim, of the Book of Chronicles. Now, reading Ezra as an extension of Chronicles is hard. That doesn't work so smoothly. But in terms of the claim that Ezra and Nehemiah may have started out separate, that actually makes a lot of sense. Here, just that we don't say we went through an entire hour and never cracked the book open, take a look at Nehemiah chapter 1, sentence 1. Nehemiah chapter 1, sentence 1. If you're using the stone Tanakh, keep on turning until you almost can't turn anymore, and then stop. The page 1837. At the bottom. You see it? Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachaliah. That sounds like the title of the book. Right? The words of Nehemiah ben Chachaliah. It really suggests that this was meant to be something that was going to be different. There were other reasons to argue it as well. There's a list that's found in the second chapter of Ezra that's repeated at length in the seventh chapter of Nehemiah. If there were really one book, why would you put the same list in twice? It's hard to justify. But in terms of where they ended up, it's very clear they ended up together for a long time until finally they were separated out. Clear? Okay. If you take a look at source number 13 on your sheets now. And I recognize this is a whole lot of background, and I hope I'm not throwing people around too much. I'm going to do a summary before the end. But I think it's necessary in order to actually know what we're talking about when we read the book, that we get this sort of introduction to it. So, basic structure you see here in number 13. I gave it to you chapter by chapter. You will find the original decree of Cyrus in the beginning when he says, go ahead, you can come back to the land. Then we move into Zerubbabel's Aliyah, the initial construction of the altar. Then the halting due to opposition from the Samaritans. Then you find them restarting the construction. Then you find Ezra coming to the land under King Artaxerxes in chapter 7 and 8. You find Ezra's acts of leadership. Then in the beginning of Nehemiah, you find Nehemiah's Aliyah under King Artaxerxes. When he complains, he's upset about the status of the city of Jerusalem. You find his administration. Then you find Ezra, as Nehemiah records it, leading a national return to God. Then the section I can best call lists, and we'll see that when we get there, followed by Nehemiah's religious leadership of the nation. About those lists. We're going to see a lot that centers on lists of names. Who came back? Who was intermarried? Who stopped being intermarried? We're going to see these lists in the book. And the question you have to ask is, what are they doing there? Do I really need to know all the people from all the tribes who came back and who did this and who did that? And it's incredibly dull reading, frankly, to the modern ear. Take a look at source number 14, where Josephus says it's not only the modern ear. He's giving you his record of the return of the Jews for the second temple, and he writes, and thus did these men go, a certain and determinate number out of every family, though I do not think it proper to recite particularly the names of those families, that I may not take off the minds of my readers from the connection of the historical facts and make it hard for them to follow the coherence of my narrations. I mean, frankly, he takes a long time to say, I'm abridging this text. that's really what he's trying to say. He says, you'd be really distracted if you sat there trying to read through all the lists of names. So I'm cutting those out here. If you really want to know, go look in Ezra and you'll see it there. That's Josephus. He says, these names are dull. We don't really need them. They distract the reader, so I'm cutting them out. Rabbi Elchanan Samet, in source number 15, this is from the virtual Beit Midrash of Yeshivat Har Etzion, suggests that it may be dull to our ears, but believe it or not, it was once considered to be beautiful, inspiring poetry. Take a look at number 15, Rabbi Elchanan Samet. He says, lists of various types are an important and common literary phenomenon in Tanakh, and the modern reader tends to ignore them generally for lack of interest. This often has a sound objective basis. Lists of names of people or places or objects don't mean the same to us today as they meant to the reader of ancient times, to whom such names were familiar and connected to his life and his environment. But this is only a partial explanation. The main reason for the lack of interest is the change in literary taste of the modern reader, as opposed to that of the ancient one, who after all represented the initial audience to which the Tanakh was addressed. He says, the main reason why it isn't interesting to us today is because our literary tastes have changed. Readers of ancient times were very fond of these lists. Some were even a sort of poetry for them, right? If you think of Yehoshua, right? In Yehoshua, you find a list of 31 kings who were conquered, and they're written in Tanakh in columns like a poem. And there are different explanations for why they're written, you know, in the column format and so forth. But the bottom line is, it was considered a poem, like a song that you would sing. These are the conquests that God gave us in our land, and these are the families who returned. Many lists are recorded in Tanakh,
in the book of Esther
as well, with the sons of Haman, very much so. He says, many lists are recorded in Tanakh specifically for the purpose of introducing a more celebratory and elevated note into the, quote, routine biblical story. And some lists are poetical in nature, even in the form in which they are written in the Torah, meaning this kind of column or staggered writing to mark it as different from prose. So when we get to the lists, and you're saying to yourself, is Torchina really going to read through each name? The answer is number one, yes. And number two, we have to figure out why. We have to figure out what these are doing there. Why is this inspirational? Why does this poem mean something to the people? Rabbi Chaim Angel, in source number 16, I referenced his article for you, The Literary Significance of the Name Lists in Ezra and Nehemiah, tries to find significance in each list, and I'll refer to his work when we actually encounter those lists. So what we've said so far, okay, what has brought us to this point, is the following. Number one, we aren't done. We don't think we're done yet. I just want to make sure to sum up this introduction. The context for Ezra Nehemiah in Tanakh really requires a knowledge of the books of the prophets themselves who describe the run-up to Ezra and Nehemiah. We need to know how the Jews ended up in exile in the first place. And so my next step is going to be to take us through excerpts from those books that will explain why we went into exile in the first place. What is the status of this nation when it goes to Babylon in the beginning? Then we have these Galut Svarim, these books about the exile, Ezekiel, Daniel, Esther, before we get to our ultimate return with Ezra and Nehemiah, as well as Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. The books are not meant to be taken as history books. They're meant to convey to us the milestones of our return and what we need to know about returning Jews, whether that's the Davidic line, the Second Temple, the leaders of the day and their significance. Those are things that we need to know. The key figures, the Persian kings, we went over a little bit. We talked about the problem of the chronology, whether this is happening in the 6th century before the Common Era, or whether it's happening in the 4th century before the Common Era. We see very clearly that our tradition wasn't really concerned with being precise about the names of these Persian kings and when they lived. It was not a major concern for us to such an extent that Ibn Ezra is very comfortable contradicting himself 2 chapters apart on the identity of Darius. the books themselves, we said, may have initially been written as two books, but as far as our tradition was concerned, they were one for a very long time, until 15th century, when we start with the printing press, we print them as separate books, the Christians having separated them long before in their system. And then we went through the basic outline of the book in number 13, and noted that we're going to see an awful lot of name lists, and they should not be discounted. They matter a great deal for the book. So I thought I would actually start us on some of the texts of Tanakh that we need to read in order to set it up, but it's not going to work that way. So what we're going to end up doing is, next week, God willing, first of all, when you come in, make sure to take one of the green Tanakhs, because we're going to be using them significantly. I'm not going to put all the verses on the sheet when we have a Tanakh that we can refer to. But we're definitely going to go Hebrew-English Tanakh for this one. We're going to talk about the sins that led to the destruction. We're going to talk about the trip into exile and the predictions of Yirmiyahu for that exile. We'll talk a little bit about the life of the Jews in exile, and then their return to Israel as predicted by Yirmiyahu. And then we'll go into the beginning of Ezra itself. So we have a lot to see, obviously, over the course of this year. I'm very glad to see so many people who are interested. I hope you'll stick with it and be back. I will say three things. One, because not everybody was here in the beginning. Make sure, please, that Joyce has your email address for the list, because I'd like to be able to send out follow-up. That's number one. Number two, with a group this size, or even a group half this size, it's very difficult to get to everybody's questions as part of the discussion. My email address is generally at the top of the sheets. I'm very glad to continue the discussion afterwards by email. So if there's something we didn't address, a question you want to ask, please email me, because it makes it easier than trying to get to everybody's questions and comments in the course of the class. And then third, there was a third note. Yes, the third note is I try to start on time. If people are here at 1:30, I think it's chutzpah not to start at 1:30. So what that means is, I apologize if you come in a couple of minutes late and miss the beginning, but I do intend to start at 1:30, and I hope that people will be able to make it at that time. Thank you very much.